This is Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th century epicure.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th century connoisseur.
And I'm Brian Bellow, 20th century geek. We're talking today about the history of the color line between black and white America. And as always, we've invited some of you to join us with your questions and thoughts about the subject.
Hey guys, another call. Daniel from Kirksville, Missouri, the Show Me State. Daniel, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you. Hello.
Hey.
Well, speaking of racial purity, I don't know whether you're aware of this, but Kirksville is the birthplace of Harry Laughlin, who was one of the foremost voices for eugenics in 20th century American policy.
Do you know a little bit more about Laughlin? You want to tell us a little bit about his life story?
Well, I'm not an expert on it, but if I recall, it's between World War I and World War II. He was writing some articles on animal genetics. He was a veterinarian and began to get interested in the emerging field of study of eugenics as it affected people.
Yeah.
And Laughlin wound up becoming one of the foremost authorities in America on eugenics before World War II.
Bad timing on his part.
Yes.
Because even though this quest for eugenics had begun to peter out in the United States by the 30s, what really killed it was the way Hitler applied eugenics. So Laughlin took that job at a pretty bad time in the history of eugenics. But in the late 19th century, early 20th century, racism developed a real kind of scientific edge to it, a real biological basis.
Or pseudo-biological.
Or pseudo-biological basis. And you might say pseudo-social scientific as well.
Yep.
You know, we kind of cast off that pseudo, but that didn't mean that it wasn't being practiced at the leading scientific institutions around
Well,
the
Daniel
country.
Suggested that it had something to do with a guy who knew about animal breeding, and probably that's the real source of eugenics, is the scientific breeding of animals for desired qualities, and that takes on a lot of steam in the 19th century.
Yeah, that does, and so did the competition between nations to build empires, mm-hmm. which went hand in hand with categorizing a lot of those peoples who were being colonized as more or less fit to be in charge of humanity.
So in a way, biology was destiny. That was the crying call of these eugenics advocates. But they thought they could do something about it.
Yeah,
so
that's
we could transcend
the thing.
Biology.
Now, the way this played out in the United States domestically is a number of people who we call progressives today argued that if we're going to compete with other nations in this competition for world power, we really need to maintain our racial purity. And to them, that meant that we needed to make sure that the white race did not become mongrelized or diminished by mingling with these lesser peoples. And we actually built that into our laws. There were laws against miscegenation in the South long before the 20th century. But even in the North, there were efforts to make sure that white people were not overtaken by immigrants of color.
Yeah, no, my mother was told when she graduated from college in 1938 from a women's college that she and her fellow graduates should go out and multiply, be fruitful and multiply. It's a great competition among the races.
And you're lucky she was told that,
yeah.
Peter.
Well, in my personal case, I'm very, very grateful to that message that she
Well, in your case, I think she just added, Peter. I'm not sure that would be multiplying.
Yeah. Daniel, thanks for bringing up this really interesting topic.
Thank you, Daniel.
Oh, you're welcome.
Turn your page to a brief demonstration. It's now in 90, it's strictly information I'm giving. Teaching on a regular basis. Today's lecture is about the races. We're not out to exaggerate or diss them, but show the symptoms and facts of racism.
I was surprised recently to discover that the word racism is a 20th century word in the American context. And it was mainly adopted after the Germans began inflicting.
Right.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
That
yeah.
we didn't even have the word racism until...
So we need the Germans to show us a model for...
But Ed and Peter, what would you call white attitudes towards African Americans? Or what did they call white attitudes towards African Americans in the 18th and the 19th century, if not racism?
why people would have called it common sense.
It was nature. It was nature.
Exactly. Nature or religion, perhaps, even.
The great debate in the 19th century is over polygenesis or monogenesis. Do we all come from the original parents? And good Christians would say Adam and Eve, of course, and they're the father and mother of us all. Or did we have separate creations? And full-blooded racism, as we came to call it, is a product of polygenetic thinking. That is, that there are multiple creations and they're of a different order.
Yeah, I don't know, Peter. It strikes me that if you think about evangelical Christianity, that they still believe in Adam and Eve, obviously. And so they had to go to some elaborate lengths to define, okay, well, let's see, gosh, where could races come from if there's only two original humans? And this is the story of Cain and Abel and Ham and being banished and punished and so forth. So to answer Brian's question, before there was a language of racism, of science, there was a language of punishment. And of God's hierarchy.
Yeah.
Right?
No, that's a great answer. And to link it to your first answer, Ed, the first thing you said is common sense. And just to remind our listeners how many people were religious, and that kind of religious understanding was equivalent to common sense in a way that it's not today.
That's right. But the interesting tension in all that, which African Americans were able to exploit all the way through slavery and afterwards, is if they too are Christian.
Then why
Christians really have a very hard time explaining, you know, is heaven going to be segregated?
I think, Ed, you're absolutely right that a notion of a single creation, that we're all God's children, is deeply, deeply subversive. And it was, of course, what African Americans in slavery and abolitionists who were working to destroy the institution, that was their fundamental appeal. It was an appeal often against science, the best science of the 19th century, on behalf of this fundamental theological proposition that we're all God's children.
And see, and that's beautiful, and there are other paradoxes in all this. So we think of imperialism as being really the sort of the interstate manifestation of racism, right? It's the Europeans keeping down the Africans or the Asians or whatever. But then you think of the missionary impulse, which is sort of carried on the imperialistic impulse. And I remember growing up in the Southern Baptist Church in very segregated situation. But I can remember Vacation Bible School, the song that we would sing that I can remember even as being 6 or 7 years old as being at odds with the culture in which I lived, which was red, yellow, black, and white, they are all precious in his sight. And I can remember singing that and kind of going, well, gee, you know, why aren't there any other red, yellow, or black children here?
And whereas I never associated planting trees in Israel with imperialism. I just wasn't as swift as you, Ed.
Yeah, right. So I recently had a chance to talk about all this complex relationship between race and science and whether things are getting better or worse with a real expert on this subject, Professor Daryl Scott of Howard University. And I asked him, how are we supposed to think about the relationship between science and race?
When slavery came to an end, it happened at a certain moment in time. And that was the moment in which scientific racism caught on in Europe as well as in America in a whole full-throated fashion. And so once the emancipated slaves are entering into the society and people are trying to figure out what should their place in society be, there's a growing discussion in scientific circles about the hierarchy of races that exist among mankind. And in all these hierarchies, people of African descent are thought to be at the bottom of the hierarchy. And so this became a justification for the continued exploitation of the free people, even though they were outside of slavery.
So it would have been, things would have been a lot better if emancipation had come in the sort of more utopian moments of the 1830s when it was ending elsewhere, you think?
Absolutely so. And this is part of the difference between the fate of the blacks in the North versus the emancipated slaves in the South.
Well, so we can actually have the language of race get worse over time. But Is there not a general trajectory by which we're becoming more enlightened about race, or has it gone downhill in some ways as well?
Well, I would take a bold step to say that in the last 100 years, one facet of the war against racism has been won, and that is, in the 1870s, there was a raging debate about whether people of African descent properly belonged to humanity.
Yeah.
And we know that this is an antebellum period debate, but these ideas continued on, and I would dare say in the 19th century, they would say black people, many would still say black people are outside of humanity, the Negro is really a beast. And there's a fundamental change that takes place even in the South. I mean, I'm struck, and I've always asked this question of students, why did public lynchings end in the South?
Now, and when was that that happened?
This happens in the mid to late 1930s. Lynchings actually increased during the early years of the Great Depression.
Yeah.
But by 1935, I usually use that as a rough dividing line, there's a precipitous decline in a particular kind of lynching, which is the public lynching, the spectacle lynching, as we call it, where whites would come from surrounding counties to participate in the lynching of a person accused of a crime but not tried, of course.
And have their picture taken with the body afterwards, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Make postcards and send them to their friends.
Yeah, right. Okay,
and so they disappear. And when we go forward just a little further, we will see George C. Wallace, and we know him to be the segregationist main spokesperson, segregation today, tomorrow, forever. And we kind of overlook the fact that George Wallace was the first judge in Alabama to prosecute a white man for killing a black person. And what is consistent is probably that George Wallace never changed his mind about the inferiority of black people, but George Wallace and his generation had changed their minds about the humanity of black people.
Wow.
And that's what I've been trying to get at here in the conversation, that there's been a shift. Whereas black people were questionably human as late as 1900 in most circles of the South, by 1940, within two generations, there's this marked shift where the racist grandfathers would not have known them, in other words.
Right.
That there's a new generation who has come to accept the humanity of black people. And once this starts taking place, particularly when you get the interpersonal interactions in the schools, people start forming friends. And then you see people changing even more. But yet, and this is where it gets really thorny, and this is where the story, you know, ceases to be a kumbaya moment. It doesn't prevent people from holding in place the stereotypes that existed 50 years ago about the relative equality of the races.
Right, I see. So what you're saying is that there is a kind of a substratum of assumptions about racial difference. And then on sort of the top of the water, all kinds of currents and waves and everything can be going on. So there's both a profound continuity and constant change in what race means in America. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I thought of all this. I mean, we all have to explain how there's this enormous body of literature about racism in America. And there is an African-American who is poised to be the next president of the United States if he wins the general election.
Right.
Now, there's some people say, oh, the Barack Obama youth, and, you know, they're not racist. And yes, I understand what they're getting at. But at the same time, because I teach and I have children, I can assure you that hierarchies are still in place. I have a friend whose son attends Harvard. And there is this notion that you don't take classes with Asians, be you black or white.
But are they not assuming that Asians are somehow superior to themselves if they're afraid to compete with them?
Absolutely. And that is the point, because to be a racist, you don't necessarily have to posit that your race is superior. You have to buy into the notion that there's a hierarchy. And I guess what I'm arguing in part is there are many people in this society who have bought into hierarchies of race. They will never carry the stigma of being racist, but effectively they are still dividing humanity in very troublesome ways.
Yeah. So it's by its very nature that race always seems natural to the people who are living in that discourse. And then after it's over, we go, what in the world were people thinking to fall for this kind of self-deception and this kind of manipulation, right?
Absolutely. But people do have to have concepts that organize themselves, okay, or even divide themselves. And whatever we come up with, it's usually something imprecise. I mean, only a computer can show 256 million colors. Okay. We need something we can put a hand on and handle and make progress with, or should we say take action with. I don't want to say make progress, but take action with.
Well, thank you so much, Darryl, for this searching conversation and for these really exciting ideas about the way that race has evolved and not evolved in American history.
Well, thank you, Ed. It's always a pleasure.
Darryl Scott is a professor of history at Howard University.
Well, Ed, I know that you're one for continuities, but it does seem that in roughly the mid-30s, using lynchings beginning to tail off as the marker, it does seem that acceptance into the brotherhood and sisterhood of humanity for African Americans is a pretty consequential moment.
You know, I think we're inclined, aren't we, Brian, to think of actually World War II and the overt ugliness of Nazism as being when even white Southerners who were deeply persuaded of the undeniable reality of racial difference suddenly saw themselves cast in a different light.
Well, you know, being so Northern-centric, I certainly teach it that way, but you putting it as white Southerners doing X or Y, I actually don't really know whether the excesses of Nazism swayed dyed-in-the-wool white Southern racists.
I wouldn't use the word swayed. What it did was it undermined confidence that the world agreed, as the world had, the white world had for a half century, that what the white South was doing was just what colonial powers were doing all over the world, and what you would have seen in South Africa, that people had agreed there was a white man's burden. And suddenly, you see this horrible language and reality of Nazism using that same language of difference and separation to lead to the horrors of the Holocaust. So it's not that white Southerners changed their minds and then dissolved segregation. It's that when a growing middle class of black Americans pressed their claims to American justice, when women like Barbara Johns in Farmville, Virginia, 16 years old, or Rosa Parks in Montgomery, Alabama, said, "We have the same respectability and religion and self-respect that you do," that it wasn't really a counter-argument that the white South had.
Well, it's happened again, guys. So much history and so little time to talk about it. Visit us at backstoryradio.org and keep that conversation going. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore. Jamal Milner is our engineer.
Gabby Alter composed our theme music. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major production support for Backstory is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the Perry Foundation Incorporated, and Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond.